Okay, so I want you to picture this. The Royal National Theatre does a massive poll. They ask like 800 playwrights, directors, actors, the biggest names in the business.
Right, the heavy hitters.
And they ask them to vote for the most significant English language play of the 20th century. So what do you think of something huge, right? Like a big war story, a sweeping family drama.
You're thinking Death of a Salesman. You're thinking A Streetcar Named Desire, something with, you know, stakes, a clear story.
Exactly. But the play that won, and apparently it won by a landslide, was a play where, famously, absolutely nothing happens.
Uh-huh. Nothing.
Just two guys by a tree waiting for someone who never, ever shows up.
And that, of course, is Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. The ultimate paradox.
That is what we are diving into today. We've got a whole pile of critical essays, historical accounts, you name it, and we're going to try and figure out why this play, a play about literally just waiting, is seen as such a masterpiece.
And we're going to unpack why it completely bombed with Vacationers in Miami, but somehow became this huge hit in a maximum security prison.
That comparison is everything. But before we get into all that, we have to do a little bit of housekeeping on the title itself.
The Great Pronunciation Debate.
Yes. Because I feel like I've heard it said a dozen different ways. Is it good D-O-O-T?
It's a real sticking point. Yeah. In North America, we almost always say good D-O-H. It sounds, I don't know, a bit more sophisticated, maybe.
Oh, more Frenchy.
But Beckett, even though he wrote it in French first, was Irish. And he was really clear on this. He insisted the emphasis is on the first syllable. So good duo.
Good duo, like God.
Exactly. That's the thing he could never really shake, even though he tried to. But yeah, for the sake of accuracy, we should probably stick with his preference. Good O.
Goody O it is. All right, so let's set the scene. And I mean, scene is a strong word here.
It's about as minimal as you can get. The stage directions are basically a country road, a tree, evening, and that's it.
No country, no year. Just a void.
A void, yeah. And into this void, we get our two main characters, Vladimir and Estragon, or Didi and Gogo, as they call each other.
Now, the script doesn't actually call them tramps, does it?
No, that word's not in there. But that's almost always how they're played, you know, with the bowler hats, the worn-out suits. They look like they've been on the road for a very, very long time.
And their whole dynamic, it's like this, this really tragic comedy routine. I was reading through it again, and they just bicker constantly about hats and boots.
It is a comedy routine, but imagine that routine has been going on for 50 years. That's how long they say they've been together. Think about the sheer exhaustion of that.
Right. There's that famous critic, Vivian Mercier, who summed it up.
Oh, yeah. The best line ever written about the play.
He said Beckett achieved the impossible. He wrote a play where nothing happens twice.
And it's not an insult. It's just literally the plot. Act one, they wait. Godot doesn't come. Act two, they wait again. He still doesn't come.
But the nothing is so full of stuff. They're terrified of silence, so they have to keep talking, keep moving, just to prove to themselves that they actually exist.
Exactly. And let's get into that, the dynamic between them, Didi and Gogo, because they're not just two identical guys.
No, not at all. They're like two sides of one person.
It's a classic duality. Vladimir, or Didi, he's basically the mind. He's the more intellectual one. He remembers things or tries to. He's looking up at the sky, wrestling with the, you know, the big philosophical question.
And he's always fiddling with his hat, right?
Yeah.
Taking it off, looking inside it.
Like he's checking to see if his brain's still in there.
And then you have Estragon, Gogo, who is the total opposite. He's the body.
Well, physical. He's always trying to sit down. He's falling asleep. He's hungry. And his whole world revolves around his feet. His boots are killing him.
That's literally the first thing that happens in the play. His opening line is, nothing to be done, and he's talking about taking off his boot.
For Gogo, the great tragedy of existence isn't philosophical, it's that his feet hurt.
Mm-hmm.
It's so simple, so human.
It reminds me so much of those old comedy duos.
Oh, 100%. Beckett loved Laurel and Hardy and Chaplin. You can see their DNA all over this. The bowler hats are a direct nod. The physical comedy, the stumbling. It's basically vaudeville.
But it's vaudeville at the end of the world.
Exactly. It's that kind of humor where you laugh for a second and then you just feel cold because you realize how trapped they are.
And they're not completely alone. They get an interruption in Act One. And this is where the play, for me, just gets really, really strange.
The arrival of Pozzo and Lucky.
Yeah. Describe this pair because it's a whole different level of disturbing.
Well, if Didi and Gogo are codependent, Pozzo and Lucky are straight up master and slave. Pazzo's this big, loud, domineering guy with a whip.
And he's literally driving this other man, Lucky, with a rope tied around his neck.
It's brutal. Lucky is carrying all of Pazzo's stuff, a suitcase, a stool, a picnic basket. He's just treated like an animal, and he's totally silent, just drools.
It's such a jarring contrast to Dee Dee and Gogo. But the moment that everyone talks about, the part that's just baffling, is when Pazzo decides to make Lucky perform for them.
He makes him dance, which is pathetic, and then he commands him to think.
He tells a man to think as a party trick.
Yes. And when Lucky opens his mouth, it's not a thought. It's a flood. It's just this torrent of academic, philosophical-sounding nonsense. He starts screaming things like, given the existence of a personal god, quack, 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 quack.
It sounds like a computer glitching out, just fragments of data.
That's a great way to put it. It's like the death of intellect. All this knowledge, all this philosophy has just decayed into noise. The engine is running, but the gears are all stripped.
And the others can't stand it. They have to physically tackle him to get him to stop.
Because it's a painful reminder of a world that made sense, a world they've lost.
So Pazzo drags him away, and we're back to waiting. And then finally, a boy shows up.
The messenger. He brings the one piece of information that drives the entire play.
Mr. Gutty told me to tell you he won't come this evening.
But surely tomorrow.
And that surely tomorrow is the hook. It's the little bit of hope that keeps them stuck there.
Condemns them to stay, yeah. So that's act one.
Then act two begins. And it is, as the critic said, nothing happens twice. It's the next day. The only change is the tree now has a few leaves.
But the characters have changed. Pazzo and Lucky come back, but they're completely broken. Pazzo is now blind.
And Lucky is mute.
It's entropy. Everything is just falling apart. The first day was bleak. The second day is worse. But Dee Dee and Gogo are still there.
Which brings us to that ending. The boy comes back. Same message. Godo isn't coming tonight. So Dee Dee and Gogo, they finally just, they consider suicide.
But even that is played as this dark slapstick joke. They want to hang themselves from the tree, but they don't have a rope. Estevan takes off his belt.
And it breaks.
It snaps, and his trousers fall down around his ankles. It's the ultimate failure. They can't even manage to kill themselves properly.
So Vladimir says, well, shall we go? And Estragon says, yes, let's go.
And then you get that final soul-crushing stage direction.
They do not move.
They're just paralyzed, frozen by that tiny, tiny sliver of hope that tomorrow might be different.
Okay, so that's the plot, the non-plot, which leads us to the question that's launched a million essays. Who or what is Godot?
The billion-dollar question.
The most obvious answer seems to be baked right into the name. Jugo, Dio, God.
It's so tempting, isn't it? And the play is just full of Christian symbols. The tree can be seen as the cross. They talk about the two thieves crucified with Jesus. They're waiting for salvation.
And then the boy says Godot has a white beard. I mean, come on.
It seems like an open and shut case, but there's a problem.
Uh-oh.
Beckett wrote the play in French first, and the French word for God is Dieu. Not God. So that clever little wordplay doesn't even exist in the original language.
Right, that kind of blows a hole in the theory.
It does. And on top of that, there's a French slang word, goyula, which means a military boot.
A boot. So they could be waiting for a shoe.
Could be. But the point is, Beckett himself hated the God theory. He famously said, if I had meant God, I would have said God and not Godot. He wanted it to be ambiguous.
Okay, so if it's not a religious allegory, what about a political one? I know people have linked it to the Cold War.
That's one reading, yeah. Two superpowers just stuck, waiting for the other to make a move. But a much more personal one, I think, goes back to Beckett's own life.
He was in the French Resistance during World War II.
He was, and he had to flee Paris when his cell was betrayed. He spent the rest of the war hiding out in rural France, basically living like a vagrant, waiting.
So for him, waiting wasn't some abstract concept.
Not at all. He knew what it was like to wait for a message, to wait for a smuggler, a Godot, to get you across a border. The boredom, the fear, the uncertainty, that was his reality for years.
That makes that final line, they do not move, so much more chilling. Because in the Resistance, moving at the wrong time gets you killed.
Exactly. The play can be read as a kind of post-traumatic echo of the war.
And then, of course, there are the psychological readings.
Oh, the Freudians and the Jungians have a field day with this. It's a perfect Rorschach test. You can map Freud's model of the psyche onto it perfectly.
Well, then yes, Gogo is the aide.
Totally. All he cares about is food, sleep, physical comfort. He's the pleasure principle. Vladimir's the ego, trying to make sense of things. And Godot is the big, absent superego. the father figure who sets the rules but is never there.
It just fits every framework you try to put on it.
And that's the genius of it. By stripping out all the specifics, no time, no place, no backstory, Beckett created this vacuum that just sucks in whatever anxieties the audience brings into the theater with them.
Which is the perfect segue to talk about the audience, because the story of how this play was received is almost as fascinating as the play itself.
It was not an easy sell at first. The Paris premiere in 53 was on a shoestring budget. I read that Lucky's suitcase was literally a piece of trash they found outside.
But the real disaster, the legendary train wreck, was Miami 1956.
Oh, the Miami debacle. It's a masterclass in how not to market a play. The producer billed it as the laugh sensation of two continents.
A laugh sensation for this play.
He booked it for an audience of, you know, well-to-do vacationers, people who wanted to see a musical after a day on the beach. They were expecting Guys and Dolls, and they got existential dread.
I can just picture them. Honey, is this the comedy?
It was a bloodbath. People started walking out in droves. Apparently, the local taxi drivers figured it out and would line up outside the theater about 45 minutes into the show because they knew they'd get a huge rush of angry customers.
Taxi for the guy who's had enough of the void.
So it seemed like the play was just going to be for, you know, the intellectual snobs. But then, a year later, everything changed.
San Quentin.
The performance at San Quentin State Prison in 1957. The San Francisco Actors Workshop took a huge gamble and decided to stage it for the inmates.
For 1,400 prisoners, this should have been an even bigger disaster than Miami.
The actors were terrified. They thought they were going to get things thrown at them. But from the moment the curtain went up, the prisoners got it.
They were silent.
Completely captivated. They laughed at the gallows humor. They understood it on a gut level. They didn't need a professor to explain what waiting meant.
Because that was their entire existence.
Of course. Waiting for parole, waiting for a letter, waiting for an appeal, waiting for a life that might never begin. For them, Dee Dee and Gogo were just them.
So was that one inmate, Rick Clucci?
Yeah, he was serving a life sentence. He saw the play and it completely turned his life around. He started a drama group inside San Quentin.
And when he was paroled, he ended up working with Beckett himself.
He did, became one of the foremost interpreters of his work. It just proves the point, right?
It's incredible. The vacationers, who had all the freedom in the world, were bored by it. The prisoners, who had no freedom, saw their own lives in it and were transformed.
It shows you it's not a play about nothing. It's a play about what you do when you have nothing but time. It's about endurance.
Now, we do have to touch on a bit of the controversy around the play. Beckett was, let's say, very particular about how it was staged.
Oh, famously controlling. But the biggest issue was always gender. He absolutely forbade women from playing the main roles.
What was his reasoning for that?
It was surprisingly biological. He said flat out, women don't have prostates.
Sorry, what?
Yeah. A recurring bit in the play is that Vladimir has to keep running off stage because he has a painful urinary issue. For Beckett, that specific male physical ailment was somehow essential to the character's suffering.
That seems incredibly limiting.
It is. And since his death, his estate has lost that fight in court a few times. The argument being that the themes of suffering and waiting are universal, not specific to a man's prostate.
Yeah, I think most people today would agree with that.
I would hope so.
So let's bring it all together. The play is 70 years old. It's confusing. It's bleak. It doesn't go anywhere. Why are we still talking about it? Why does it still feel so relevant?
I think it's because the core act of the play waiting is maybe the most fundamental part of being human. Take away the hats and the boots, and we are all Dee Dee and Bogo.
We're all waiting for something.
For the promotion, for the test results, for the weekend, for the political situation to get better. Most of our life is spent in the in-between, waiting for the real thing to start.
And Godot's big, terrifying message is, maybe it never does.
Right. And it asks you, what do you do in that waiting room? Do you support the person next to you, like Dee Dee and Gogo do, despite everything? Or do you put a rope around their neck, like Pozzo?
It's funny, the bad guys in the play are the ones who are actually going somewhere. The heroes are the ones who just stay.
There's a strange kind of loyalty in what they do. They could leave. They talk about leaving. But they don't. They kept their appointment. There's a sort of, I don't know, a dignity in that endurance.
And it's just soaked into our culture now. I mean, Sesame Street did a parody called Waiting for Elmo.
Which is just brilliant. Grover and Telemonster wrestling with existential despair by a lamppost.
And for any of you who are in software development, you've probably heard of the Godot game engine.
named because the developers felt like they were always waiting for it to be finished. Which is, you know, the perfect metaphor for any big project.
It is. It really is everywhere. We started this whole thing saying it's a play about nothing. But I think I'm with the San Quentin prisoners. It's not about nothing. It's about everything.
By taking out the story, Beckett just left the life.
Well, I think that's a pretty perfect place to leave our deep dive. We've gone from a plotless plot to a buffet of interpretations, all the way from Paris to a California prison.
A lot to think about.
So a final thought for you to take with you. We spent all this time asking, who is Godot? But what if we flip it around? If you're Didi, if you're Gogo, standing by your own tree, who are you keeping waiting? Are you someone else's Godot?
That is a heavy question.
Thanks for waiting with us on this deep dive. We'll see you next time.
Surely tomorrow.